As tired as some of us may be, we are really very sorry that our time together, stretched, surprised, worried, inspired, angered, hopeful, all of the emotions, must end. When we did this for a first time last year, when we really had no idea what this kind of enterprise would be, how it would work, one of the things that many people asked during that session and after the session is, what can I or we do about the things that we have talked about and learned about these days we've spent together? All of us leave some of the lectures and tutorials, you know, white hot with excitement and even sometimes passion about things that we may have felt before or may never have even felt or thought before. How can we capture, people asked us, some of that energy that we feel as we're leaving a particular event, bring it home with us and allow it to ignite something among our friends in our communities that brings these ideas to others and even more importantly to some kind of concrete action. So we asked a selection of our presenters this week to close with an idea, the kernel of an idea at least, that they could share with all of us. While ideas alone have undeniable power, and certainly history amply demonstrates that ideas alone have enormous influence, we also would like to think about concrete ways, little or large, in which we can take home some of these things that have moved us over the last few days. So each speaker will come up to the podium, identify himself or herself, and then share with us something that he or she would like us to leave with. Once they have all spoken, Walter Isaacson, President and CEO of the Institute, will come to the podium and bring this second annual Aspen Ideas Festival to a close. And we thank all of you very, very much for spending these days with us.
Hi, my name is James Bennett. I'm the editor of The Atlantic, and I'm not really certain what I can tell such an accomplished group of listeners that you don't already know, including, of course, that you would be missing out if you weren't already reading The Atlantic. But I can tell you a conclusion I've reached for myself, one that this gathering over the last few days has crystallized for me. For the last 15 years, I've had the reporter's great privilege being able to cross all kinds of boundaries, ask any question and its follow-up. For a reporter, if you're lucky enough in your assignments and you're energetic enough in carrying them out, life is kind of an endless Aspen Ideas Festival, one in which you get to convene every panel and ask every question. Bad reporters learn to ask just enough questions to pad out the story they already had in mind when they set out. Good reporters learn to keep asking questions in the conviction, which is almost always rewarded, that life is a lot more complicated than you think, and that even the simplest of people and the crassest of politicians is capable of profound thought and feeling. So I've had the chance to listen to criminals and presidents and scientists and metal stampers, and there's some overlap in all of these, auto chiefs, suicide bombers and people who are bereaved by their attacks, militiamen, preachers. I've argued about my own faith and his with a leader of Islamic Jihad, and I've spent hours with a heartbroken Israeli soldier who is fighting in Gaza, whose mother is an Israeli Jew and his father is a Palestinian Muslim. And now, a little like somebody going home from Aspen, I find I've become an editor, which is to say a guy behind a desk, someone who gets a lot of his information as experience of the big world secondhand. So, as I leave here, I've resolved to find ways to keep going places I wouldn't otherwise go, keep hunting up people I would otherwise never meet, asking just one more question, and stretching my own capacity for empathy. So, thank you. Happy hunting.
I'm Michael Posner, the president of Human Rights First. As our name suggests, our role is to make sure that the important issues of human rights have a place at the table. Throughout the last week, we've heard lots of discussions about three sets of social issues which lend themselves to involvement and engagement. Issues relating to poverty and development, issues relating to the environment, climate change, issues relating to human rights, in particular crisis situations like Darfur and the Congo. I think all of us that are involved in advocacy in any of those areas have a sense that time is not on our side, that we need to act urgently, and that existing institutions of government and the private sector are not doing enough to resolve those issues. So I have really three sets of ideas quickly. First, for people in government, second, for the corporate sector, and third, for all of us as citizens of the world. For government, the big idea is that there needs to be a relook at the relationship of the U.S. and the world and world's institutions that are trying to make a roadmap, create rules of the road for this new global environment in which we live. Justice Breyer, several days ago, described what he and his colleagues go through, trying to understand the new rules of the road for lawyers and for courts. The Aspen Institute, with Alice Henkin's Justice and Society program, over the last 25 years has brought together seminars of federal judges, including Justice Breyer and about 300 others, to look at international human rights, refugee, and humanitarian law. We should be doing the same things for legislators, same things for the executive branch. There needs to be a recognition that the world is changing and the United States, ever much the leader, can't do it alone. We have to end this notion of U.S. exceptionalism, a sense that there's one set of rules for the world and another set for the United States. So my sense, I want to say one idea just with respect to that and it relates to Darfur. This morning Karl Rove said, and I'm sorry he's not here, the United Nations has failed on Darfur. Somebody said in a panel we had the other day that that's like saying Wrigley Field is at fault because the Chicago Cubs lost another game yesterday. The United Nations and the United States have got to work together on problems like Darfur. We've been trying to get the United Nations to appoint a prominent U.S. citizen like Bill Clinton or Colin Powell to be the U.N. envoy on Darfur to make it work. And we've met resistance both in the United States government and from the United Nations. To make our world a better place, the U.S. and the U.N. have got to work together. I'll be quick. Secondly, I want to say to corporations, one of the things we've seen, certainly in the environment on issues like climate change, in the development agenda and in human rights, is that in the void, corporations increasingly are stepping up to the plate with non-governmental organizations to find creative solutions, to try to reach a way of getting sustainable development, sustainable environment, sustainable solutions to human rights problems. We've worked over the last 10 years with the apparel industry, with companies like Nike and Reebok and Adidas, and Liz Claiborne and Nordstrom's to try to figure out how to deal with the supply chain, how to create workers' environments throughout the global supply chain in their manufacturing. Anybody in this room who works in manufacturing, has any outsourcing anywhere in the world, ought to be learning from that model. My admonition to those of you in business are two things. If you're working on any of these issues and it feels good and comfortable, you're not pushing hard enough. Secondly, you need to be a leader. If you're going to be a leader in the future, there needs to be some combination of looking at sustainable environment, development, and human rights all as a comprehensive package. You can't do this a la carte. and you ought to be looking at the best practices and making sure that your company is there. Finally, and Walter, give me 30 seconds on this. For all of us as citizens of the world, we have the biggest responsibility here, because it's absolutely clear that left to their own devices, government leaders, those in the UN and other institutions, as well as companies, aren't going to do enough. Citizen advocacy is the way that we're going to make change in the world. Karl Rove today talked about the role of the American Legion in pushing the Flag Amendment. That's what gets results, when people organize and they take what matters to them and they push it. So my advice to everyone in this room is this: follow your passion. When you get up in the morning and read the newspaper, turn on the news, ask yourself what really upsets you. On a visceral level, what matters to you most? Follow your passion. Figure out what do you have in your background, is in work, at home, who are your contacts, what kind of community organizations do you belong to, and make a difference. Get involved, get involved, get involved. Thank you.
Yeah, my name is Arthur Mutambara from Zimbabwe. I'm in the opposition in Zimbabwe, fighting for human rights and fighting against extreme poverty. It has been a great opportunity and experience for me to be here for the whole week. But so what? What can I do? What can you do? What can we do? There are three levels at which I'm going to address this question. The first one: we must celebrate and cherish the very notion of a festival of ideas. Secondly, we must understand and leverage the interconnectedness of global challenges. And lastly, we must be clear in our minds on the next steps to achieve and measure success. One, why should we celebrate the notion of a festival of ideas? Remember, it was a festival, not a battle of ideas. Precisely because all ideas are important, we must cherish the diversity of ideas. That's one thing I can do, to cherish the diversity of ideas. Of course, some ideas can be wrong. Of course, some ideas can be right. But how are you going to know which ideas are right? How are you going to know which ideas are wrong if you don't have a festival of ideas? We must realize that the solutions we seek, the solutions we must have, must be compromised solutions, must be hybrid solutions. It's not either or, it's all of us. Remember, we all want the same things. We might disagree on how to achieve those things. We might disagree on who is we. We might disagree on whom to include or to exclude from the we. We might disagree on the priorities and importance of the different things. We all want the same things. So let's cherish, let's understand and embrace a festival of ideas as a way of life. Secondly, interconnectedness of global challenges. What are the global challenges? Stem cell research, global warming, extreme poverty, human rights. You cannot work on global warming without understanding the interconnectedness of the different and various global challenges. You won't be successful, you won't be effective, at least as you tackle your favorite idea, which could be global warming. Remember, there is extreme poverty. Remember, there's a struggle for human rights in Zimbabwe, where the life expectancy is 34 years, where there's 85% unemployment, where there is 90% of the people in Zimbabwe living below the poverty line. I am saying you can't do everything, but at least remember the interconnectedness of all global challenges, and your solutions must necessarily leverage that interconnectedness. Achievement of success and the measurement of success. It's not enough for me to come to the Aspen Festival of Ideas and debate and listen to the great thinkers and politicians. I must become a player. You must become a player. Pick your favorite idea. pick your favorite two ideas and become a player. Move from being an analyst, move from being an observer to become a player. I want to be a player. I can't be a player. I want to be a player. However, it's not enough to be a player. You must be a winner. Now, being a winner is a function of understanding your idea. I'm going to pick my idea. You're going to pick your idea. Make sure you understand it. Make sure how it's interconnected with other ideas. Make sure you understand there's always a gap between idea and execution. Please, let's close that gap between idea and execution. I'm going to close the gap between an idea and execution. You must become a player and then become a winner. However, it's not enough to become a winner. What kind of winner? What kind of victory? It's not enough for you as Americans to have a national agenda, to have a national victory. Even in that national victory, make sure it's an inclusive victory. The humanity of America, the dignity of America, the success of America will be judged by Guantanamo Bay, will be judged by the ghettos of America, will be judged by the starvation and misery in Darfur, will be judged by the misery and starvation in Zimbabwe. We must seek global victory. We must seek what we call a holistic, inclusive global victory, so that when you are successful as Zimbabweans, when you are successful as Americans, the globe has succeeded. So please, I can be a player, I'm going to be a winner, and I'm going to work towards a unified and holistic and inclusive global victory. I'm going back to Zimbabwe to fight for human rights. I'm going back to Zimbabwe to fight against extreme poverty. But as I do that, I'll remember the stem cell debates. I'll remember the issues around global warming and make sure I leverage those ideas in my struggle. I hope you do the same thing. You become... Let's all become players. Let's all become winners. Let's seek to acquire and achieve holistic and inclusive global victory. Thank you very much.
I'm David Dubal, and this morning I gave a talk and a lecture performance with Jung Lin, the pianist. And I'm very glad that the festival is now starting to more deeply acknowledge the arts, which I believe that there are many ways of poverty, and there certainly is the poverty of the soul. I, too, want to be a player, but merely a piano player. And I don't want to be a winner. I just want to have the solitude to be able to continue reading, drawing, and doing the things I like. And there's many, many forms of poverty of the soul in this country. We can't help Zimbabwe or anything else if we can't become spiritually more attuned to something that may be enigmatic to us in a very materialistic world. As a matter of fact, we'll not be able to go past where we are or ever experience any kind of artistic ecstasy until we release and realize that the philosophy of materialism is totally hostile to art, something that is never discussed. Gore Vidal, thank you. That was not enough applause. Our great problem at this moment is that, as Gore Vidal puts it very well, yes, there is art, but there is no idea of art. And that is in every school system. In fact, you can be beat to a pulp if you like Beethoven or John Keats if you go to certain high schools. I was on a subway and a man, 60 years old, he's humming from the Beethoven Ninth. And I'm where did you learn that? He said, oh, for 50 years ago in high school. And his son is sitting next to him. And I said, does your son like Beethoven? Oh, he hates it. Oh, there is a great hatred for classical culture, and we better get going, because without that, all the materialism is not going to feed our soul very much. The first thing I must say is that the bad art is absolutely beyond our conception. The educational system, long outmoded, is just powerless to confront the might of the economic junk culture. And bad art, and we don't understand this enough, hurts the psyche of society. If the pervading art is bad, then the style of living will be extremely lacking in manners, physical dignity, nobility, and certainly in last but not least, elegance. Look at the clothing of the populations. Look at the clothing. I mean, if you have any artistic consciousness and you look at these baseball hats on every living human being in New York, whatever their class, you could die. But we deny this. We actually deny these feelings because we have to get through the day. We are crowned by the universal baseball hat. Can you imagine Clark Gable kissing Vivian Leigh in a baseball hat? So bad art is a social offense, and as the citizen in Julius Caesar keeps shouting, tear him for his bad verses. And absolutely, bad verses in advertising copy or bad lyrics in junk music, it's a crime against society, and it cuts very deeply, but much more subtly than many of the things that we have been talking about in this festival. So, as I said, I'm increasingly very happy that the arts will, I think, now more than ever be a part of it. What can we do? Well, you know, you have to, as parents, you've got to say to your children, yeah, I'm going to school, and I'm going to talk to the principal, and I want to make certain that you and your class act every single semester in a Shakespeare play. Absolutely. I couldn't care less if the greatest verbal artist of any country in history is a white European elitist. I don't think he knew what the word was. But the fact is, we have to really give them piano lessons. I mean, someone 40 years ago could make a tremendous living as a private piano teacher in the suburbs. Today, you're lucky to have a piano in a house. The home used to be not a house with... A house was not a home without a piano. So we have to begin. Learn Bach. Learn how to play an instrument. Get rid of this passivity. It's not enough just to listen. Start getting up in the morning instead of the New York Times. Screw it. Last week's paper was the same. Do something for yourself, which is take a piece of paper and each day... do a drawing. Start there and end it. Then sit down for 20 minutes. Look at some space in your mind. Have no one around you and listen to some great music. Goethe said, no day shall ever pass that I do not read a good poem, look at a good picture, or hear some good music. This is past. And because it's past, there's something very, very important that's lost. And there's much we can do, but we're not doing it.
I'm Sidney Harmon. With Michael Eisner, we are sponsoring the new Arts at Aspen program that takes us back to the roots David reminded us of. I asked him to stay with me at the podium for a moment because after listening to his joyous comment, I wanted to make a personal gift to him. Here it is.
I want to say that I had a 327 batting average in Little League. That I know every statistic from Christy Mathewson to Bob Feller, and because I can't be a baseball player, that's my abiding despair.
Thank you, David. I want to take the privilege that is mine as a member of the Board of Trustees to pay my special respects, my gratitude to Elliot Gerson, to Kitty Boone, and to Jamie Miller and their associates for having mounted a superb David, that rivaled the applause you asked for. My mother and Robert Frost, I discovered here this week, had something in common. My mother once said to me, "Darling, I, your mother, was born with a think switch. Every time a matter of consequence occurred to me, I would turn on my think switch, think about it, and when I was complete with that, I would turn it off. You, my darling, either were born without a think switch, or it was locked in the on position at your birth." Robert Frost, Brian Greene, that incomparable Brian Greene, reminded me, said something to the effect that the human mind is an astonishing instrument. It turns on automatically when we get out of bed in the morning, and it does not turn off until we get to the office. The magic of this week and the magic of Walter Isaacson's Aspen Institute is that it ennobles the idea, it respects the idea, and it does not cringe at the elitist notion that that is not quite enough. No one leaves a place like this after a week like this without having made some determination to rejigger, affect some constructive effort that had not occurred to her or him before. The fact that this institute, through the Ideas Festival, moves to ennoble it satisfies a deep-seated desire of mine for decades. Nobody has spoken to this journey more beautifully than did Albert Tennyson in his heroic poem, Ulysses. I use the last 15 minutes of my time to share with you this lovely, lovely passage. "Much have I seen and known, cities of men, manners, climates, governments, and drunk the light of battle with my peers. I am part of all I have known, yet all experience is an arch wherethrough gleams that untraveled world whose borders fade forever and forever as I move. How dull it is to pause, to make an end, to rust unburnished, not to shine in use. All of you, leave here, continue, please, to shine in use."
I'm Nigel Cameron. I run a project in Chicago called the Institute on Biotechnology and the Human Future. But in the theme of following that, let me share with you the piece of verse that was in my mind most this week from, of course, Ogden Nash. "The rain raineth on the just and also on the unjust fella, but chiefly it rains on the just. The unjust's got the just's umbrella." The project which I direct is focused on bringing together disparate parties on the questions raised by new technologies, parties who often aren't on speaking terms. And, of course, as a transplant Brit, who finds himself here in the States as a kind of social conservative, although being a transplant Brit, I'm not quite the same as my peers. I've sought to bring people together across the abortion divide and sought to bring people together to have a common conversation about the questions raised by biotechnology, nanotechnology, convergence of technologies among persons of conscience from across the culture, and indeed to bring them together with people in the corporate community and the policy-making community. So it's been a particular delight to spend this week sharing in passionate persuasion across the divides of civil society, which so often keep us apart, as we seek perhaps to rehabilitate our national discourse at a time when, and this is one of the few things I think we can all clearly agree, such conversation has become particularly difficult. And of course, we do this not because ideas are ultimately unimportant, and there are plenty of people who believe we should all be agreeing with each other for precisely that reason, but because we are convinced that all human action flows finally from human thought, and every human society is often quite unselfconsciously the working out in time of particular assumptions about what it means to be human, and therefore where the human good is to be found. And so, I have found myself an interesting dialogue with radical feminists, environmentalists, mainline pro-choice religious people of different stripes, bringing them together with those whom I more naturally agree with in the more conservative social community, and asking the question, if you take the abortion issue and some other determinants of our national conversation off the table, where do we find our commonalities? Because to many of us, the biggest questions that will be faced by the human race can be summed up as, how can we embrace new technologies without embracing the brave new world? How best can we apply the Renaissance, the Enlightenment, inheritance that we all share to secure a future in which human dignity and human rights take center stage? And of course, as those who are passionate about ideas in the policy arena know, unless you are truly partisan, you are unable to be bipartisan. So what to do? Well, I leave here reinvigorated in my commitment through these many conversations which I have been privileged to share, in my commitment to help drive a civil society conversation on the significance of emerging technologies for the human project, the human spirit, and looking afresh for partners to build that dialogue, both here in the United States, which is my happily adopted home, and around the globe, because, of course, it is on the global stage that these fundamental questions will finally be resolved, and that the question, the central question which we each of us confronts, of where the human future lies, will finally appear. It needs to appear through the best confluence of ideas, and I am grateful to you for this opportunity of reinvigorating my commitment in that task. Thank you very much.
Hi, I'm Brian Green, physicist at Columbia University, and this has been a wonderful week, wonderful experience, many enlightening moments. Perhaps the most satisfying for me, though, was two days ago, as the sun was beginning to set, it was kind of dark, not that many people around. I looked down one of the walkways, and I saw a couple walking along, walking away from me, both of them going, I wanted to quickly share with you something that you probably already saw in the New York Times on Saturday. I only just saw it this morning. It was about, it's this article here, about an evangelical pastor who was giving a 21-city road tour. And just let me read you a quick couple of paragraphs. It'll just take a moment. He wore black pants and a shirt and spoke with the awed enthusiasm of someone describing a U2 concert, moving from gee whiz discussion of physics to questions of how God might move in other dimensions, like those discovered by mathematical string theorists. When you get to the subatomic level, he said, everything we know about the basic makeup of the universe falls apart. The physicists use phrases like, we don't know. So high-end quantum physicists are starting to sound like ancient Jewish poets. Now, I don't know how my colleagues feel. I do not mind being compared to an ancient Jewish poet. But the mangling of science, of course, in support of non-scientific ideas, non-scientific applications, is problematic. But that's not what I'm going to talk about, because that's been talked about here in the religion, science, interface, and various other discussions. Rather, this article brought to mind for me a tangential issue, but one that I think speaks to a particular kind of failing of science or scientists, at least in getting an appropriate image out there. And it's a failing that itself was tangentially spoken of in an op-ed that, again, some of you may have seen some months ago by Nicholas Kristof, called, I think it was, The Hubris of the Humanities, where he described how, in educated circles, it's considered barbaric not to know about Beethoven or Shakespeare or Goethe. But it's okay if you don't know about square roots or pi or how energy comes from the sun. That kind of knowledge you don't have to have to still be educated. Now, Kristof went on to say how we have to change that. Obviously, we're in a world where science and technology are playing an ever bigger part in our daily lives, and we need to shift that sense of what it means to be educated. But to me, it raises a somewhat different issue, which is, how did that particular way of thinking about the world come to be? Where did this kind of science phobia and this willingness to not know about science come from? And I think part of it certainly is, when we think about Beethoven and Shakespeare and Goethe, we think they speak to our humanity, right? They touch us. They allow us to raise up and live on a different plane for just a moment, so that when we come back, we can appreciate the human condition in a way that we couldn't before. But science? Science doesn't do that, we all think. And why? Well, because science is often taught in a way where it's intimidating, where our students have to memorize facts, and they're early on in their studies brought to bear on the details and the technical mathematical underpinnings. And it's my strong belief that if we would teach science in a different way, if we would bring the big, wondrous ideas out in the open at the beginning, then we would have a completely different way of thinking about science. Look, I've seen this happen. I've seen an 8-year-old kid, when I've spoken to him about black holes, the eyes open up. The fire is lit. I've gotten letters from teenagers who didn't know what to do, but encountered some popular book on science or some television show, and it changed their lives because then they found what they wanted to do. I got a letter from a truck driver in Texas who kind of humorfully wrote to me and said that his buddies were mad at me because he didn't go to the bar any longer and go drinking with them because he wanted to go home and read my book. Wow, that was great. So what I'm saying is, science can touch us in a deep way. Science, if communicated in the right way, can lift the spirit like the best of symphonies. Science can give us a connection to the cosmos that's deep and satisfying. What I'm saying is, we all know that science can enrich the mind. We all know that science can give rise to technological wizardry that gives us cell phones and personal computers and such. But what we often don't talk about, or at least we don't communicate to our young, is that science can also nourish the soul. Thank you very much.
First, I'm a little nervous about my clothes. But and it's not easy for me to give advice. I tend to sound like a cross between Dustin Hoffman and The Graduate and a Chinese fortune cookie. You know, I supposedly, the only, you know, give blood, join the army? Was it going to plastics? Chinese fortune cookie. I read some comic program. They said the only bad message nowadays you can get in a Chinese fortune cookie is, you know, you finish this Chinese dinner and you eat the fortune cookie and look at the message. It says, "I like Ike." I know what I'm taking away. One, after this lovely concert we just heard, some of us were lucky enough to hear it, so lovely. I'm going to make more time to listen to music. I'm going to take that away, and I'm going to take away a considerable optimism. Look at how well this was organized. How many different people are here from so many different perspectives talking very articulately, or even if not articulately, communicating something of importance. The discussion, the interest, the activism, you cannot go away from here without considerable optimism. Now, what about... thank you for that. And of course, the message, I mean, everyone's articulated the same message for this group. You say, well, get involved. That's coals to Newcastle or water to the Pacific Ocean or whatever. That's not Fiji water. See, it's on my mind. But the point that I like to tell the high school students and sometimes the legal audience is I say Tocqueville is interesting. Why? To me, he's interesting because it's 1840, more or less. A long time after the Constitution, but a long time ago, and he asks the question that we're asking. Why does democracy work in this country? Why doesn't it go way off the track? Why aren't there waves and moods that really produce terrible results? How do we do it? And his answer is, after looking around, he came, you know, to write about prisons, which were not in good shape, and still aren't. But he came and found how American society worked then and not so differently now. He said, look at the number of organizations. Look at the different interests people have. Look at how they spend their time, not just at work, though they do spend time at work, not just in their family, but that's important, but also in civic groups of every variety, of every shade, of every possible interest. They get involved. Voluntary associations, voluntary interests. They learn how to talk to each other. They learn how to communicate, and they learn how to resolve their differences. That's why maybe one of the most important things when I was in grammar school, and is still there, was that left used to be the left-hand side of the report card. You know, can you work in small groups or you try to dominate them? I mean, that's still there. You know, it was used to be called reasoned self-discipline, which I usually flunked. But that's there. That's there. That learning, those differences, that's what's called getting involved. And that's why the only thing I could possibly add to what other people were saying, because this isn't the right group to preach to, they are involved. And we say involved, and I agree with Posner. I think he was absolutely right. But we want to pass that on, too. And I think that's part of what we're worried about. Can we pass that on to the next generation? And that's part of what we have to do. And so, of course, we want to pass that on. And we'll probably pass it on pretty much the way you pass anything on. You try to pass it on in part through example. And you may try, I hope, maybe call some of the school systems. Are they teaching civics? Fine. Maybe from a very selfish, self-interested point of view, you'll decide to adopt a judge. And judges can't, they can't defend themselves. So when they say something way off the track, it has to be you. They get bad criticism. You think it's wrong. They've either maybe not given the death penalty or whatever it was, and they're attacked or some such thing. It has to be you who has to answer. They can't defend themselves. But most important, I think it's pretty easier than I thought, to get involved in local school systems, to go and say, you know, you want to hear what I have to say for half an hour? They'll love it. They'll love it. And they'll take it in. And maybe they'll learn, because I learned this from Larry Summers. He repeated it. He's right. You know, there's a supply side, the demand side. That you want to get that demand side. The demand side, they want to be involved. And I can say to them, hey, I have this document called the Constitution, and I can't tell you if it will, I can't tell you what to do, but I do, as I said. I can tell you this, that document won't work if you don't participate. And I might, if I really get carried away, go into Pericles. I love this thing of Pericles, where he said, you know, the funeral oration. I read this somewhere, I think, in Derek Bach's book. He said, what do we say of the Athenians? What do we say in those 2,000 or 3,000 years ago, 2,500 years ago, in that first democracy? What do we say of the person who does not take part in politics in Athens? And by politics, he meant community affairs. What do we say of that man? We do not say that he is a man who minds his own business. We say he is a man who has no business here. Yeah, it's tough, right? Tough, but we believe it. And then the other part of that, maybe in your own lives, as I try to do with my law clerks, maybe a little, and tell them this through example, telling them by doing it, you're a lawyer. Does that 25, 30-year-old lawyer in your firm, is he going to have the time and the inclination and the model to do what we all believe in so strongly? Are my law clerks going to have that? Is your young business associate going to have that? Will you encourage him to what? Well, we believe life, in part, is made up of three things, that personal part, that very often, luckily, means family. And that professional part, so important, we're not fulfilled without it. And also that, what I'd call that community part, that we're more than individuals, we're more than just ourselves, we live together in communities, and we fight with each other and with all over the... That's what it is, community life, to try to work things out. That reasoned self-discipline on the report card, that learning how to work together, that I think has made those 200 years of American history. And of course, I go away more optimistic than ever. It will continue to do so. Thank you.
I am a trustee of the Aspen Institute, and please allow me to leave you with two prayers, one from the Quran and one an interfaith piece. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, praise be to the Lord of the universe, who has created us and made us into tribes and nations, that we may know each other, not that we may despise each other. If the enemy incline towards peace, do thou also incline toward peace. And trust in God, for the Lord is the one that heareth and knoweth all things. And the servants of God, most gracious, are those who walk on the earth in humility. And when we address them, we say peace. The second, O God, you are the source of life and peace. Praise be your name forever. We know it is you who turns our minds to peace, to thoughts of peace. Hear our prayer in this time of crisis. Your power changes hearts. Muslims, Christians, and Jews remember and profoundly affirm that they are the followers of one God. Children of Abraham, brothers and sisters, enemies begin to speak to one another. Those who were estranged join hands in friendship. Nations seek the way of peace together. Strengthen our resolve to give witness to these truths by the way we live. Give to us understanding that puts an end to strife. Mercy that quenches hatred, and forgiveness that overcomes vengeance. Empower all people to live in your law of love. Amen.
On behalf of the Aspen Institute and all of us who work here, I want to thank you for coming to Aspen for this Ideas Festival. Those of you who are presenters and those of you who are participants, it's great to have you. We hope to have you back. As we learned this week, ideas are powerful things. But as Shashi Tharoor told us at the very beginning, even more important and even more powerful is tolerance for other people's ideas. And that's something I think we learned this week. There are very few places in this society today where there's a public commons, where people with different ideas, different faiths, and different commitments can come together in the spirit of sharing ideas and perhaps opening up to other people's ideas. As Jim Collins said from this stage, the notion of the public commons is something we have to preserve in our society and hope all of us can be part of that preservation. As Nigel said here earlier today, there's just too few places like that. It's also important when we come away from the commons, when we come away from finding the common good, that we ask ourselves, what can I do? That was the theme we closed with. And I do hope every morning you ask yourself, well, what can I do now that I have shared these ideas and have this sense of optimism about what our country and our world could be? As Tocqueville said, as Justice Breyer quoted Tocqueville as saying, it's our ability to form associations for the common good that is probably the defining characteristic of who we are. And as Arthur said, become a player. And to me, to become a player means forming associations for the common good. That's what we hope to do with this Ideas Festival, but even more importantly, we hope to do it in everything we do at the Aspen Institute. I hope you will look upon this Ideas Festival as not just a week to come and go, and maybe come back again and then go again, but as an entry point to all that we try to do at the Aspen Institute, and that all places like the Aspen Institute around the world try to do. Anything that may interest you, whether it's education or the environment or foreign policy, we try to have programs where we can take thoughts and put them into action. So please feel free to join all that we do at the Aspen Institute in all of our forums, not just our Ideas Festival, because we hope this is not your exit point, but your entry point into the Aspen Institute. And now it's my great pleasure to ask you to indulge me while I thank a few people, because there really are a lot of people to thank here. First of all, from The Atlantic, James Bennett, the great new editor of a great magazine, a magazine 150 years old, sorry. You don't look a day over 125, James. And David Bradley, one of the most gracious individuals, my friend and partner. I'm sorry to tell you all that he was so excited about these various things. He really decreed at breakfast that we do a lot more of these. And Michelle, he wants to do the World Biomedical Forum with you, everything else. So I think we're going to have a long-standing partnership with The Atlantic. John Fox Sullivan, who I sat next to on an airplane 2.5 years ago, and we said, hey, why don't we do something like this together? Elizabeth Keffer was with him. Meredith Coppett, Paul O'Neill, who did such a good job this week. Their superb staff. Thank you, everybody at The Atlantic Monthly. Great partners. And there's been this is an amateur event. This is not something like, you know, some of these great conferences with Fortune magazine throws one here where they have a conference division of 120 people, you know, full time. There are about 8 or 10 or 12 people here who work extraordinarily hard and then call everybody else in the Institute to come in and volunteer. Deborah Murphy handled logistics and travel awesomely. And I don't see Deborah, but I'm going to point some of them out. They should wave. Jim Spiegelman, and his parents are here, so I have to say something nice about him. Jim Spiegelman is there he is, truly calm. Jamie Miller. Jamie. Liz Judge. Liz. Edith Elliott. Will Newton. Helped everybody get all around. Gene Duffy. Paige, Alicia, and Hannah. Is Hannah here too? Paige, yes? Over there. And by the way, let me do a little plug for another organization I'm involved with. When Paige leaves, she goes back to rural North Carolina to teach for America. Thank you, Paige. Alexis Law, Sogan Suspasi, Anna Eliasson, I saw you a moment ago. Becky Ward, who's been here, one of the great stalwarts of the Aspen Institute. And to totally embarrass him because he's just walking in, I'm going to say Jeff Burkus, who's built us a new building that we'll be in next year, our architect, so we'll be in the Dorr-Hosier Hall for next year. And, of course, the Aspen Meadows staff. I see Tommy Kiersey back there. I see Jason McEachin. Jason's here because his brother Lake is the one who does all the work, and he's back there doing the work. Chef Christian Clegg, great meals, everything. Rob Walker, who is the manager of the Aspen Meadows. Where's Chef? TJ, JP, appreciate all your work, too. I also want to thank somebody who's leaving us, Christina Wilkie, who's done a lot of great work. There she is on the way back with Becky. I can thank her because she's not going too far. She's going to be working with Queen Noor, so it just means we'll have Queen Noor back as often as possible. Elliot Gerson for putting it together. My wife, Kathy, I have to put that in. She had to put up with me. Thank you, Kathy. And the person who truly has to put up with me, otherwise Kathy would never put up with me, is Pat Zendulka, my assistant who basically runs it. Thank you very much, Pat, really, for everything. Amy Mardrum, who's the true person who runs the Aspen Institute. Amy. There she is. And finally, the most awesome person on this planet, Kitty Boone. A standing ovation for Kitty Boone, and now let's all have another drink. See you all next year.